From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. The mighty, magnificent American chestnut tree was the one-time monarch of Eastern American forests. A near-perfect tree, it was called. 100 feet tall, trunks more than 10 feet in diameter, straight-grained and rot-resistant. But it was not blight-resistant. At the turn of the 20th century, in the course of just four decades, an invasive fungus killed 4 billion American chestnuts. Conservationists and scientists have been trying to bring it back ever since. U.S. Forest Ranger Rex Mann remembers how his father was moved to tears talking about the trees that once grew in North Carolina.
Everything changed for me in that moment. I'd heard chestnut stories all my life, but it hit me. This tree wasn't just the foundation of an amazing ecosystem stretching from Maine to Georgia. It was the foundation of a culture, a way of life, now gone forever.
But maybe not forever. Scientists say they've been able to create a blight-resistant version of the American chestnut. Key is, it's genetically modified, and they want to release it into the wild to reproduce. But should they? Or would that itself be another dangerous, irreversible chapter of the story of these trees? This hour on Point, genetic engineering and saving the American chestnut. And you can join us. What are the advantages and the risks of introducing a genetically modified tree into the wild? Would you do that to save threatened tree species where you live? What's your question for the scientists and conservationists who are trying to find the best way to save the American chestnut? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Well, we'll begin today in Syracuse, New York, with William Powell. He's the director of the American Chestnut Research and Restoration Project and a professor at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. He's one of the lead scientists behind the genetically modified blight-resistant version of the American chestnut. William Powell, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, Professor Powell, if I can, before we get to the specifics of your research, it's been so long since we've had these vast tracts of American chestnuts in this country that I was wondering if you could just sort of describe to us in more detail how critical this tree species was to so many states and such a large portion of this country for centuries.
Absolutely. So the American chestnut was one of the most common trees in the eastern forests, especially along the Appalachian Mountains. About one out of every four trees in some areas were the American chestnut. And it was a keystone species, as you mentioned in the introduction. A lot of wildlife relied on the American chestnut. It produced a very stable mass crop, meaning a nut crop for anything from bees to bears would rely on chestnut. So the pollen, the leaves, the nuts, all were very important. And we lost all that. We lost that when a blight was introduced from Asia. People started importing Asian chestnut trees. They didn't realize at that time, this was before a lot of people knew about microbes. They were carrying over all these different microbes on these trees. One of them, a fungus called Cryphonectria parasitica, jumped off the Asian trees that came here and landed on the American chestnut and turned out to be a very virulent pathogen.
So this is what, in the early 1900s, 1904? Four thereabouts, or that's when the fungus was first identified?
That's when it was first identified. It actually probably came in the late 1800s. When people started importing these trees, we're not sure exactly when it actually hit, but 1904 is when it was first described at the Bronx Zoological Park. But, you know, again, chestnuts were important not only for wildlife, but also for farmers. One of our first deans of our college, he wrote about chestnuts, and he said it was claimed in certain districts that farmers realized more income from the sale of chestnuts than any other farm product.
Right.
And that's pretty amazing because these weren't orchards of trees. These were just wild trees.
Yeah.
So people just could go out into the woods, so to speak, and collect the nuts, and send them to the city for sale, and had an extra income
Yeah. So William Powell, hang on here for just a second, because sure. we actually have a little bit of sound that underscores the point you're making about not just the natural, but the economic importance of this one species in so many parts of the eastern United States because of the nuts, those chestnuts themselves. So here you're going to hear historian Ralph Lutz speaking to the WBOR podcast Endless Thread about the importance of the American chestnut in southern Appalachia.
It was not just a food that was a treat to them. It was a central part of their lives economically, particularly the very poor. And when you had the time of plenty in the autumn, when the nuts were falling like manna from heaven, it was almost a community celebration. So many people were involved in it. And there were more nuts than people would gather. It was a bounty. There was a woman who once said, a chestnut grove is a better provider than a man. Easier to get along with, too.
That's historian Ralph Lutz speaking to the WBUR podcast, Endless Thread. William Powell, it almost defies the imagination to know that a tree that was once so critical and so plentiful, that in the course of, 40 years, this fungus could spread so rapidly that it killed 4 billion trees.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Scientists and government officials tried to stop it the best they could. They had a big conference in Pennsylvania trying to put everybody's minds together to figure out, how can you actually stop this blight from spreading? And they tried to, isolate the infections, by cutting trees ahead of the spread. That didn't work because they didn't realize at that time that the chestnut blight also lives on oak trees. Mm-hmm. And so you can remove all the chestnuts and it still spreads through that area on the oaks. So, the only way to bring back the American chestnut, because now the fungus is basically endemic, it's part of our forest ecosystem now, is to make a tree that can tolerate the fungus. And that's what we're doing here.
Okay. So let's talk more about that. You have created a blight-resistant, fungus-resistant version of the American chestnut. How? What is genetically different about the tree you've created?
Okay, so it's actually a very small change. We actually were approached by members of the public back in 1989 asking us to, can we do something different than the Backcross breeding program, which is where they're crossing with Asian chestnuts, and use some of the more modern techniques at that time of genetic engineering. And so my colleague and I, Chuck Maynard, said, well, we'll give it a try. And so Chuck, who had some experience with plant tissue culture, started developing the method of putting genes in. And I started looking, because of my background with chestnut blight and molecular biology, started looking for genes that can actually confer resistance. And the one that we came across that works really, really well is actually a gene that comes from wheat. It's actually not just from wheat, though. It's actually a ubiquitous gene. It's found in all grains and many other plants, and it's actually found in fungi and mosses. It encodes an enzyme called oxalate oxidase. And what this enzyme does, it detoxifies oxalic acid. Now, you might ask, why is oxalic acid important? Well, this is how the fungus actually attacks the tree. The fungus will get into a wound in a tree and live off the dead tissue. It's a necrotroph, so it lives off dead tissue. And then it starts releasing this acid. Hmm. And this acid will then kill more cells ahead of its growth, and then it lives off those dead and dying cells. So what we found is that, if we could put this enzyme in the tree, or actually the gene for this enzyme, that will detoxify that acid. And it actually does. And it makes the tree tolerant to the acid and also resistant to the blight.
Does it change the tree in any other way?
Nothing that we can see. And we're doing all kinds of environmental tests. We've fed pollen to bumblebees. We've looked at leaf litter decomposition, at allopathic effects on other seed germination. We've looked at actually wood frog tadpoles eating the leaves. Did all kinds of different tests. And we don't really see any difference between the wild type and these ones that now have this extra trait to defend themselves against the blight.
Yeah. So many questions. This is so fascinating, William Powell. First of all, I guess one of the fundamental questions in science for these long-lived species like trees mm-hmm. is, can you know for sure, or can you predict for sure all the possible outcomes of this slight genetic modification over the, what, century-long life, typical lifespan of a chestnut?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And what you have to think about, though, is what are we doing compared to what everybody else is doing with American chestnut? And there's big programs out there to make chestnut hybrids. A lot of people plant chestnut hybrids. Matter of fact, one of the most popular planted one is a Dunston chestnut. You can actually get that at Walmart. And these are crosses between Chinese and American chestnuts. So in that case, you're actually bringing two whole genomes together, you know, tens of thousands of genes from organisms that have evolved on opposite sides of the globe. Then you have like the back cross breeding program, which is actually better than that because you take those trees and breed them back with American chestnuts to make them more Americanized. And it's not because we like American, but because it makes them more adapted to the forest mm-hmm. that they came from. Okay, and so that's a better program. But see, what we're doing actually is only adding a couple genes to the tree and giving it a new trait to tolerate this yeah. acid. And actually, in some ways, it's not really totally new. The Asian chestnut can tolerate oxalic acid also. What we're doing is by adding a single gene that's very common into the environment. In a way that the Chinese chestnut does it, it actually uses four genes and it has a biochemical pathway. So it's a little more complicated in the Chinese chestnut, and we're doing it in a more simplified way.
Okay. And you say that you're ready to – or you're approaching readiness to maybe plant these trees out in the wild.
Okay. So we've actually done field trials since 2006 on our trees under USDA permits, which, you know, you have all the rules and stuff that you have to follow for that. And we are now getting ready to submit applications to the regulatory agencies for their review and using all the data that we've collected on our tests and stuff. And hopefully they will approve that, and then we can actually start distributing these to the people yeah. who have been waiting for these for years and years and years.
And if you get that regulatory approval, I believe I'm reading here that it could be the first time in U.S. history where a tree, a genetically modified tree at least, was approved for spreading out in nature. So we're going to talk more about that when we come back. William Powell, Director of the American Chestnut Research and Restoration Project. Hang on here for just a minute. We are talking about efforts to save the American chestnut. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the magnificent American chestnut trees and efforts to save it or to bring it back because, of course, early in the 20th century, a chestnut blight wiped out 4 billion chestnut trees in the United States. And ever since, scientists and conservationists have been working to try to bring it back. One of them is William Powell. He's director of the American Chestnut Research and Restoration Project. He and his team have crafted a slightly genetically modified version of the American chestnut that seems to be blight resistant. And they say they're close to being ready to try to gain regulatory approval to put that genetically modified tree out back into nature. William Powell, I've got a couple of quick questions specifically about the differences between introducing a genetically modified organism or tree back into nature versus other methods that we were talking about earlier, like the back crossbreeding, right? Because with crossbreeding, you're still dealing with trees of the same species. They just might be different breeds. Whereas if I understand what you've done with the genome of the American chestnut correctly, you're introducing a trait into the American chestnut that doesn't necessarily exist at all in any breed in the species right now. So that is – it is slightly different than the genetic meddling that humans have been doing with plants for thousands of years.
Okay, so small correction. Okay. Actually, hybrids are hybrids of different species. They just happen to be close enough in relation that they can cross, that they don't always cross well. I mean, even in chestnut, when you cross two different species, let's say Castanea mellissima, the Chinese chestnut, and Castanea dentata, American chestnut, sometimes you get things like male sterility. Sometimes when you make other crosses between different species of chestnut, you might get something like what's called IKB, or internal kernel breakdown, where 40% of the nuts just disintegrate in the nuts. Mm. So, you know, these hybridization is actually a large shuffling of genes. And there are genes that, you know, are for a plant is adapted to a different environment than what we are here at the United States. So with genetic engineering, the great thing about that is that the American chestnut trees that we have produced are basically 100% American. They have all the genes that allow them to be adapted to the eastern forest. We just added the trait of blight resistance. Okay, so we're not changing a whole lot to the tree. And therefore, in many ways, genetic engineering could actually be a better way to do restoration in the environment, because that's one of the goals you want is to make as small a change as possible, and therefore the tree would be adapted.
Mm. Well, I want to play a little bit of sound here from Hank Craddock, of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. You'll hear him looking at some American chestnut seedlings that haven't been killed off for blight, and this is for an oral history project about the American chestnut in southern Appalachia.
They're not extinct because they survive. In fact, look, here's a blight-killed tree right here. This one got chestnut blight and died back to the ground, and that has sprouted from the base. Even if you walk in the woods, the American chestnuts that were killed by the blight, some of them have kept coming back from the roots because the fungus only eats the bark.
That's Hank Craddock of the University of Tennessee. So, William Powell, if the fungus only attacks the bark, and when the tree dies back, we still have a healthy root system. I mean, I heard you say earlier that the fungus is endemic in American forests now.
Yes.
But is there... I mean, it sounds like you feel a sense of urgency in terms of wanting to put this genetically modified version of the tree out there. Is there that much urgency if we still have healthy root systems from the chestnuts in American forests?
Absolutely. And what he said is absolutely true. They are surviving. There's actually millions of stump sprouts still out there. And that's really important for a restoration program, because you need that genetic diversity and local adaptation in that diversity to be able bring back a restoration population. And so that's very important to have there. Every year, we start losing more and more of those stumps. Those stumps do resprout. The roots aren't resistant or anything, by the way. It's just that they're protected by the soil microorganisms. And they resprout. They will get the blight again, and they'll be killed back down to the ground. It's in this kind of Sisyphus-like cycle where they keep going through it, and then eventually energy runs out in the roots and they die. And I've seen lots of people tell me that, you know, oh, they used to have all kinds of stump sprouts out here. Now they don't sprout in anymore. So there is that urgency that over time we're going to lose that genetic diversity. And therefore, we need to do something soon. And we actually have a solution right now that we can use.
Well, let's get a quick call in here. Let's go to Lee, who's calling from Thetford Center, Vermont. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi. I have 2 points. One, I have read that transgenic procedures result in unpredicted alterations in the not only in the inserted foreign transgene, but also in the gene of the host plant. So how long have these transgenes been tested for? Will these chestnut trees live as long as the originals? Will they somehow suddenly go downhill? I have a second point, too. The fungus is also a living, evolving creature, and it's going to be faced in a tree that it invades that's a transgenic with this new transgene. But over, you know, decades, hundreds of years, or 100 years in the life of a chestnut, won't the fungus also evolve to become, to be able to overcome the transgene? Are we in danger of producing a super fungus?
Right. Lee, two excellent questions. So let's start with the second one first. William Powell, could that happen? Could we create a super fungus?
Interesting question. And that's actually, you know, we think about that kind of stuff when we were developing these trees. And that, you know, kind of pushed us into one direction for which gene we actually chose. We chose the oxalate oxidase gene because it doesn't actually kill the fungus. It makes a tree tolerant. And tolerant is a type of resistance that basically evolutionarily is more stable than if you actually killed the fungus. And that's because you're not putting any selective pressure for that fungus to overcome that type of resistance. You know, this fungus is still surviving fine in the environment. So it's going to have a low probability of being overcome. It definitely won't become super fungus. There's no reason for it to do that. But this is probably a very stable type of resistance. We are not just relying on that. We will probably take these trees and actually combine it with breeding and try to bring in other resistance genes together so that you have what's called pyramiding, and therefore you have a longer possibility of stable resistance. We're also looking at other genes that might confer resistance, especially to other pathogens such as Phytophthora in the south. So we are considering all that and working with that in mind.
Mm. And I think Lee also asked a question that echoes in part something I asked you earlier about understanding all the perhaps emergent properties that could come from a transgene, as she said, being inserted into an right. organism that has such a long lifespan.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing she said, you know, about other changes in the genome when you do the insertion.
Yes.
Actually, you get many more of those, like a tenfold or higher, than when you do hybridization. When you hybridize, because these genes don't all line up between the two species, you have a lot of crossing over, a lot of rearrangements. So you have a lot of induced mutations, and you don't know what those are. There's a totally unknown. But with genetic engineering, we know exactly where the gene went in because we can sequence the DNA. We actually are sequencing the whole genome to find out, you know, is there any major rearrangements in the whole genome? And we haven't seen any so far. So, you know, that is actually another advantage of genetic engineering is that you have less likely of a chance of making unknown changes elsewhere in the genome.
Right. Well, I'm lingering at the edges of this conversation, though, is always that lesson about human hubris and natural systems. But William Powell, stand by here for just a second, because I want to introduce into the conversation Rachel Smolker. She joins us from Colchester, Vermont. She's a biologist and co-director of Biofuel Watch, an advocacy group that's focused on climate and the environment. She's co-authored a paper titled Biotechnology for Forest Health, The Test Case of the Genetically Engineered American Chestnut. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Rachel Smolker, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what is your view on the possibility that this genetic modification could help save the American chestnut? Do you welcome it?
No, I don't welcome it. I think, you know, the American chestnut, the loss of the American chestnut was a huge loss, and I do appreciate that. But I don't think that we can bring the American chestnut back by engineering its genome. I think that the potential for that succeeding is pretty slim. The tests that have been done so far have been done on very young trees. I believe they're all less than 15 or 20 years old, and these trees live a long time. So we don't know how stable this will be over the course of time. And we know that there are other pathogens like Phytophthora that was mentioned that are also threatening the American chestnuts. And we also know that in the bigger context, we're faced with climate change and drastic changes to forest ecosystems that are associated with that. So introducing these trees back into the forest is going to be a monumental challenge. But there's another reason that I don't welcome it, and that is the bigger picture of tree biotechnology. There is a lot of research and development on genetically engineering various different species of trees. The American chestnut was chosen as a test case, and it was chosen as a test case because it is recognized that there's a lot of public opposition to genetically engineering trees, and especially forest tree species. And you know, the public opposition is very clear. The Convention on Biological Diversity made a decision, I think it was in 2011, to adopt a precautionary approach towards genetically engineered trees. And there's been quite a long history, which people can read about in our report. And the chestnut was chosen as essentially a PR tool, a test case to try to win over public approval because people love American chestnuts.
Chosen by whom?
Well, you can, again, refer to our report. There is a chapter on this, and there's quote after quote after quote from various different sources, some of whom, you know, for example, Maud Hinchey, who is formerly with Monsanto, who says that chestnuts are a noble cause, and they like to, she likes to support these projects that might not have commercial value, but chestnuts are a noble cause. Scott Wallinger, who we also refer to, this pathway of promoting GE chestnut as forest restoration can begin to provide the public with a more personal sense of the value of forest biotechnology and receptivity to other aspects of genetic engineering, and so on and so forth. There's a whole chapter with quote after quote from various different sources. And it's very clear that it was chosen deliberately and very explicitly as a test case for other genetically engineered trees and the entire sort of forest tree biotechnology realm, because people love American chestnuts. And it was thought that by promoting this example of a beloved tree in the context of restoring it to nature, as opposed to what many of the other tree biotechnology research and development is oriented towards, this would help win public opinion. Yeah. So, I mean, the other, you know, the world of tree biotechnology is very much oriented towards commercial and industrial purposes, altering the lignin content of trees to make them more amenable to biorefineries and making fuels, or making them resistant to stresses that are associated with industrial plantations for pulp and paper industry, and so on. So that's the main focus of tree biotechnology. It's not about, you know, a public good, restoring nature, beloved American chestnuts.
William Powell, respond to that here, because, I mean, I'm looking right at a page of Rachel Smolker's report, and she talks about your group, the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, saying that your project receives fundings from companies with financial interest in advancing the public acceptance of GE trees, as well as biotech in general. Funders have included Monsanto, Duke Energy, and the GE tree company ArborGen. So, are you the tip of the iceberg for Monsanto and the like to genetically engineer American forests?
Wow. What a conspiracy theory. This is amazing. We got started because people in the public actually came to us and asked Dr. Mader and I to start this project. It wasn't some kind of conspiracy to try to make people like genetic engineering. It's actually, this is a tool that people came and said, can we apply this tool to the chestnut? You know, their report is so biased. They don't report in there who are our major funders. I mean, we've gotten $250,000 from the general public in crowdfunding campaigns. You know, most of our funding recently has actually come from philanthropic donations. You know, we get funding from everywhere. And so this is a noble project. I would agree with that. And people can donate to a noble project no matter who they are. I don't know who made the rule that, you know, corporations can't donate to noble projects, you know, for some reason. So my thing is I have one goal here. Two goals. One is to bring back the American chestnut because it was so important. And secondly, these techniques can be used to save other trees. Now, I'm not interested in industry. I'm interested in things like emerald ash borer, hemlock woolly adelgid, sudden oak death of out west, you know, thousand canker disease of walnut. The list goes on and on. Our forests are really being challenged by exotic pests and pathogens. And my goal is to be able to have all the tools in the toolbox. It's not a silver bullet. It's something, though, that can be very useful. And that's what I want to do. We have not patented these trees. We're not trying to get, I'm not trying to get my retirement fund from this, you know, anything like that. It's really just, you know, a great project that, you know, we're trying to do good for the environment. I work at an environmental college, and that's our goal, is to protect the environment.
Yeah. Rachel Smolker, respond to what William Powell is saying.
Well, I think it's, you know, again, refer your readers to the report, because it's, you know, quote after quote after quote, that this is being used as a test case to win over public opinion towards the use of biotechnology in forests. And I think Mr. Powell, you know, surely must be aware of that. I don't question that he is sincere in his desire to see the chestnut restored, and that there is a broad public that supports that that goal. But I think we're doing this in a context, and the broader context we can't be blind to.
Can I just jump in here? We just have half a minute before the break, and I've got some follow up questions to ask you, Rachel. And I don't want to have to squeeze those questions in your answers before we take a break here. So hang on for just a moment, Rachel Smolker and William Powell. We are talking about efforts to save the American chestnut, including an effort that's being led by William Powell that involves a slight genetic modification to the DNA of the chestnut tree, and he says that's ready to be tested out in nature. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere. And no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about efforts to save the American chestnut tree, including possibly putting genetically modified trees, slightly genetically modified trees, out in nature, because William Powell, who is the director of the American Chestnut Research and Restoration Project, his group says that it is ready to try to put a blight-resistant tree out into nature. We're also joined by Rachel Smolker. She's the co-director of Biofuel Watch, an advocacy group focused on climate and the environment. And so, Rachel, I had a kind of a big picture question for you here, because I heard you say that one of your biggest concerns is the use of, or the interest in the use of, genetic engineering or biotechnology in general in forestry or forest products for American forests. But I mean, aside from exclusively protected forests in the United States, the trees of America they have been managed. They are a crop, so to speak. So do you just have a fundamental objection to using any kind of genetic engineering in forestry and forest products at all?
Well, I would flip that around to say that I have a strong motivation to see natural forests protected and not necessarily, you know, managed, as you say, you know, which, you know, we look at what's happening with our forests. They've been so damaged, so over-harvested, so threatened by the introduction of pests and pathogens, which is, you know, something that really needs to be addressed. That we're losing nature, you know, we're losing the forests. And so my interest is in seeing that we do the best we can to protect and preserve what remains of natural forests. And I don't think that introducing genetically engineered trees into the forest is the way to do that. I would say our efforts would be better spent improving our phytosanitary regulations or restricting trade in plant materials, which is where all of these pests are coming from. And then once they get here, they find a very favorable environment in our forests, which are stressed in many ways and thus have less resistance to these pests. So there's a lot of things that we could be doing. And I don't think, you know, going in and tinkering around with their genetic legacy is the way to address the problems that they face. I also would point out that with most forest tree species, we have very little experience with with genetically engineering them. Our experience with genetic engineering mostly comes from crops that we've been that have been domesticated and that we've been tinkering with, if you will, for hundreds of years, not thousands of years. In the case of forest tree species like the American chestnut, we have virtually no experience relatively, and so we're really going into new territory. And I think our efforts could be better spent with less risk doing other things to protect our forests.
Okay. So let me get William Powell to respond to that. William, Rachel just outlined two or three different other kinds of efforts that could go into helping save or possibly revive the chestnut. What do you think about that?
So I can agree with her on some of those things about, making sure that we don't bring in new pathogens into the forests, and our forests are being devastated by past introductions. The thing is, though, it sounds like she's just like, let's just don't do anything. Let's just hope for the best. We're going to be losing more species than just the chestnut coming up, and we need all the tools. And I'm not saying that genetic engineering is the only tool. In fact, it would be used in combination with breeding and other things. With the American Chestnut Foundation, we actually have this document called the 3BRRR document, where we're kind of combining the efforts of biotechnology, breeding, and biocontrol. So it's really kind of a group effort to really bring this tree back, as well as other trees.
Well, to Rachel, though, she didn't say do nothing, right? She was talking about keeping invasives out of the United States, about eradicating the fungus from, as you say, that's endemic here already. She wasn't saying do nothing. She was just simply saying put the brakes on doing the genetic modifications.
Right. But if you put the brakes on genetic modification, then you're basically condemning the trees that where we have a pathogen already here. The things that she says might be great for preventing future pathogens from coming in, but even though there's never 100% with that. But really, to me, by saying the things she's saying that, well, basically we can't restore the American chestnut, because there is no other effort that has been successful but the genetic engineering.
So Rachel, one more question for you, because there's another voice that I do want to bring in here. But I do, we're talking about, as we've all acknowledged, we are talking about trees. These are organisms with lifespans well beyond, the average human. Both of you have made the point that we have to consider that when we think about any efforts to protect or strengthen the trees of North America. But earlier, William Powell talked about the emerald ash borer or the woolly adelgid attacking hemlocks. And I'm thinking, these are species that very quickly can damage, eradicate, and kill off entire forests, that the time span these invasives or these pathogens are acting is very, very short. So why not also look for solutions that may come out of human labs that fight back on that same shortened time scale?
Is that a question for me?
Yes, it's a question for you, because what William Powell is saying is that he can introduce right now into the environment a fungus-resistant chestnut tree. So why not do that instead of waiting for the multiple generations it might take through the back cross breeding programs, for example?
Well, I would first of all challenge the idea that we can right away introduce a successful blight-resistant chestnut, because, as I pointed out earlier, I mean, and as William Powell has said himself, we need to this single gene modification with the wheat gene is not likely to succeed on its own in restoring American chestnuts. And I'll just read you a quote from our report. Eventually, we hope to fortify American chestnuts with many different genes that confer resistance in different ways. Then, even if the fungus evolves new weapons against one of the engineered defenses, the trees will not be helpless. So, this tree is not going to, with a wheat gene in it, is not going to, it's very unlikely that is going to succeed. And as I said also earlier, it has barely been tested in very young trees. And we already know that young chestnut trees are more resistant to the blight. So I would just start with that and challenge the time frame issue. It takes many, many, many years. I don't know how long Mr. Powell has been working on engineering a wheat gene into the American chestnut, but it takes a long time to engineer a tree for some possible, maybe potential role in addressing some of the health concerns that our forest health
are
faced with. So I think it's really, really key to look at the bigger picture and think about, you know, other issues. Forests are much better at, trees are much better at resisting pathogens when the forest itself is healthy.
Yeah.
So, there are a lot of other things into this picture besides, oh, we must engineer the genome.
So, William Powell, go ahead and quickly respond to that.
So I just want to correct a statement she made that young trees are more resistant than older trees, and that is patently false. We actually do our assays on small trees because we can do lots of them at one time, and we infect the wild-type trees and the genetically engineered trees as well as Chinese chestnuts as controls. And in the wild-type trees, they will die in a matter of weeks. They are not resistant whatsoever, but our trees do survive. And you can go to our website, and we actually have videos showing that that you can watch.
Actually, for both of you, we could actually spend quite a bit of time over the important details here. But I only have about 6.5 minutes left in the show, and I do have one more guest who's been patiently waiting, and I want to bring him in and give him a chance to give us his thoughts on this issue here. So, William and Rachel, stand by for a moment. Hank Greeley joins us now from Stanford, California. He's the director of the Stanford Center for Law and the Biosciences, and he's written extensively on legal and ethical questions around extinction and science and extinction. So, Hank Greeley, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
And I do appreciate your patience here because it's been a fascinating conversation. I'm sorry I didn't get to you earlier. But you've written sort of broadly about how science and the law should be considered when it comes to human efforts to, in certain cases, reversing extinction or stopping extinction here. What is your take on the debate we're hearing over the American chestnut?
Well, I have to confess I'm not an unbiased listener here. I am one of the donors to Dr. Powell's foundation. I think I used $50 to try to twist it to my own nefarious ends. So I'm in favor of the chestnut restoration. I do think that our regulatory scheme for biotechnology changed organisms, whether they're on farms or as pets or in forests, does need to be improved. Our current scheme doesn't make a lot of sense. We need a better scheme. Whether we can get a better regulatory scheme out of the Congress is unclear. Having said that, though, we've got 5 billion trees that are dead and a species about to be wiped out. To say that we can't do anything to try to save those, well, it reminds me of my youth and people saying we needed to destroy the village in order to save it in Vietnam.
But just to jump in here again, to be fair to Rachel Smolker, she didn't say we can't do anything. She's highlighted a number of other things that we can do. Her concern is that this isn't necessarily an effort to save the tree for the American chestnut's sake, but rather to open the door to soften the public's opinion on genetic modification in forestry more broadly.
Right. Although I didn't hear her say much about saving the chestnut as opposed to improving forest health generally. However, the fact that she's making the classic slippery slope argument that once you do A, then B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, etc. will necessarily follow. If you are opposed to biofuel plantations with genetically modified trees, fight biofuel plantations with genetically modified trees. Don't fight against restoring a native tree that is going extinct because of an invasive pathogen. If you're worried about armies of cloned warrior slaves, fight armies of cloned warrior slaves. Don't fight any biological research that involves cloning. The slippery slope argument is attractive, but it means giving up any immediate good step because of fears of longer-term speculative harms. And if those harms start to arise, fight them then.
Hank Greeley, though, I want to just point out one thing, that if I'm reading this right, if William Powell's experimental trees do receive federal and regulatory approval to be put out in nature, that that would be a first. And that would set a precedent, the very precedent that Rachel Smolker is concerned about. So, you know, you're saying that perhaps she shouldn't worry about a slippery slope. But once that precedent is set, it doesn't seem out of the realm of reason to be concerned that other tree species, other modifications could follow.
That's certainly true, and each of those modifications should be viewed on its own bottom, with its own pluses or minuses. Once the Wright brothers took off at Kitty Hawk, it did lead to 9/11. That doesn't mean we should have stopped all of aviation. We need to think about the uses. We also need, and this is an area where I think our current system is not very good. Mm. We need a really good system of monitoring what exactly is happening once you do make one of these introductions. We also need plans about what to do if something goes wrong, plans for ways to try to, if there is a mess, plans in advance or ways to try to clean up the mess. And our current system isn't very good at that and needs to be better.
Right. Rachel Smolker, would you like to respond?
Well, I would just say, you know, I think we do need to be very careful about slippery slopes and not dismiss them, because we have a lot of experience with slippery slopes. You know, they are slippery. And I would just refer your listeners to the report, Biotechnology for Forest Health, which is at stopgetrees.org/chestnut. And read for yourself, because, you know, this is a short program, and there's a lot that I think people need to be apprised of. Mm. On this issue.
Well, William Powell, Hank Greeley brought up an interesting question that perhaps you can shine some light on. Do we have a plan of what to do if, for example, the trees don't behave as you expect in the nature, in the wild?
Absolutely. We actually have a USDA grant from the Biotechnology Risk Assessment Grant panel to actually look at our trees compared to Bacross trees, to hybrid trees, to mutational bred trees. And we're going to be following those ahead of the release. We're already planting those. And we will be able to detect something that might go wrong, even though it's very unlikely. So chestnuts, you got to remember, chestnuts are not a weed. They're not going to kind of just spread everywhere. They're going to go where people plant them. So if we had to, which I can't imagine us doing it, we could actually go out and recall these trees. But that is so unlikely that, you know, I don't even think it's worth discussion.
Right. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation this hour, and I know we've got a lot of loose ends that remain untied. So for anyone listening who wants more information, I would encourage you to go to onpointradio.org, where we have lots of links to Rachel Smolker's report, to William Powell's research, and Hank Greeley's writing on science and ethics and extinction as well. So William Powell, director of the American Chestnut Research and Restoration Project, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Rachel Smolker, co-director of Biofuel Watch, an advocacy group that's focused on climate and the environment. She's a biologist as well. Rachel Smolker, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And Hank Greeley, director of the Stanford Center for Law and the Biosciences. Hank Greeley, it was a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And again, folks, go to onpointradio.org for more information about the American chestnut. And, you know, we talked about some other trees and pathogens as well, you know, the emerald ash borer, the woolly adelgid. Let us know what the threatened species are, where you live, and how you would like to save them. Again, that's at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.